So we're going to shift now, I guess, to another disease, emerging disease, not re-emerging, I suppose, Fusarium race 4. And we're going to have two speakers, the same setup as before. Each will have 30 minutes. I should have mentioned this before for the speakers. Your clock is here. And with some would not pay attention. So with 2 minutes remaining, a yellow light will come on. And I don't know what happens if you go over time. But we won't have to find that out, I'm sure. But without any further ado, so actually, again, for those of you who came in late, the format here is each speaker will have 30 minutes, and then we have 15 minutes for a question and answer. And if there's time after each presentation, we'll take some questions. But remember, we have the 15-minute time allotted for question and answer after. So without further ado, our first speaker, I want to introduce Bob Huttmacher, who's going to share with us the California experience on Fusarium race 4. We used to think this was a California-only problem, but apparently it's not.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Sorry for having to speak about this as being not only a California problem now. I'll say that one of the things that that spurred us into starting to look at Fusarium issues in the field in California, we've been aware of race one issues for a long time. But back around the year 2000 or so, 1999, we started looking a lot more intently in California because we were concerned about what was happening with the Australian couple of races that they've been dealing with for since the 1990s in Australia. And in the process of looking for the Australian races, we found race four. So a number of people have been involved in this series of studies over a long time. This is something that certainly was an evolution because we didn't really know what we were looking at initially. I certainly want to acknowledge that Mike Davis, a retired plant pathologist with UC Davis, was instrumental in a lot of the early work and identification and a lot of follow-up work, along with Rebecca Bennett, a former USDA a USDA person who was formerly at the Shafter Research and Extension Center in Kern County. And again, I want to thank the support of the Cotton Incorporated, a lot of the different groups in California for support of this over the years, including California Cotton Alliance, Cotton Growers Association, as well as CI and the seed companies. So this is what there's a photos here that show something about what this looks like in the field in early identification. You can see in the upper right the things that are fairly symptomatic of, you see some small seedling disease type of symptoms where the plants died quite early, as early as the first to second leaf stage up to maybe sixth or seventh leaf stage, and then you see some significant stunting that occurs. In the early stages, particularly in the Pimas, it's real common to see some of the foliar symptoms that we're used to looking at for FOV. A lot of these leaves don't survive later on. If the plant survives, then those leaves are abscised and you don't have access to looking at those symptoms anymore. A lot of the things that I've looked at over the years as an extension specialist has been these early calls, which are pretty easy to miss up there in the upper left. You'll see that little spot there where there's a small stunted area. If you dig down underneath there, you'll see that there's a few dead plants. A lot of the farm calls are to look at the fields that are in like in the upper right. And then as you progress, then the calls work their way toward the ones in the lower part of the screen. And the screening trials that we've done looking at varietal cultivar comparisons are done more typically in the fields that look like those on the bottom. The evaluation approaches that we've used basically for doing cultivar comparisons involve root vascular stain ratings, whole plant foliar symptoms, single plant foliar symptoms, height and stem node, node numbers as an indicator of vigor or growth impacts, and we can also look at plant survival in a lot of the settings. I emphasize root vascular staining because again, this is different than if you're in our experiences in looking at race one FOV, where you can almost look at a stem cut, even a cross section, and you can get a pretty good indication of kind of presence, absence of the vascular staining. That it is not at all our experience with race four, and that's why we pretty much have a protocol where we pull the plants out of the ground and have to do a longitudinal cut down through at an angle and usually it involves repeated cuts to try to identify presence, absence of the vascular staining. And this is just a real quick kind of indicator, especially on the bottom there, of vascular staining. We have a 0 to 5 scale rating system. And you can see in the center there what we would constitute as a 2 or a 3. 5 is really when you have a plant that is going to die or is in the process of dying. When you see very deep cross-sectional staining. Something like a 1 or a 2 or a 3 is more typical of what you see there in the middle. And again, the foliar symptoms are not always a great thing to rely on, except when you're at the very early part of the seedling stages, because again, a lot of these damaged leaves will fall off the plant, they'll upsize. So the recommendations that we've come up with in working with growers, with seed companies, with field scouts, in recommendations for field scouting is that this is, again, you can treat it more like a seedling disease in terms of the timing. So the scouting is most successful, easier to do, cover a lot of territory in an entire field if you do this early. If you want to differentiate between seedling disease losses, again, what you're doing is looking for vascular staining in the tap roots. It's very symptomatic of Fusarium in general. It doesn't separate race 1 versus race 4, but again, that vascular staining is at least symptomatic of Fusarium oxysporum. If you start later, you go into mid-squaring, you go all the way into early bloom, well, then the evaluations are still similar. You may find foliar symptoms, but a lot less likely unless you're working with some moderately susceptible varieties. The vascular staining will be present. It's a lot harder to find this, and then one of the things that makes it a lot easier to decide if you're going to go ahead and sample is if you can still find the presence of some of these plants that died at the early seedling stages. So what we try to recommend to people is to scout seed production fields as early as possible using this type of approach and give extra care in doing so. In our experience in samples that have been sent through Mike Davis's lab to me, done with an Agdia quick test, the ones that we're aware of that were done, I'm just identifying those that came through me and the farm advisors in California. And we have a progression starting in 2001 with one field identified. And then basically we had three different counties in the San Joaquin Valley with nearly simultaneous, starting in 2003, locations, and then things expanded from there to where we're now up to confirmed fields that I've been involved in confirming of over 400 through mid-2017. So again, it's present in all of our cotton-producing counties in the San Joaquin Valley, which is the primary production area for cotton in California. We have not, that I'm aware of, identified it in the Southern California production regions at this time. One of the things that came up in the first couple of years is that no question that the most damaged plants were the susceptible Pima cultivars, particularly things like Phytogen 830, Delta Pine 744 that were really dominant varieties at that time. But it became really apparent as early as 2004, 5, and 6 that if you wanted to answer the question, is FOV4 a Pima-only disease, the answer very clearly is no. And to the extent that I have a lot of confidence in working with the growers and consultants that we have good relationships with, there's quite a few fields where Pima plantings were not part of the background of an infected Acala or upland field. So having, you know, even 1 year of Pima production from a highly susceptible variety is not a prerequisite for having an infected upland field. And the level of damage that you could see in really susceptible, ultra-susceptible varieties, you could see versus a more tolerant variety. Phytogen 800 is a good early example of an FOV tolerant variety shown on the left. There in the middle where you're looking but can't hardly find a plant, that's DP744. And we've had locations where we get essentially 100% kill susceptible varieties, like some of the Pimas. Mike Davis and some of his graduate students have done some repeated studies where they've looked at a range of different cultivars in order to be able to describe that the FOV race 4 is an inoculum density dependent disease. You know, when you're looking at what the plants are exposed to out in the field, part of the reason why you see a small spot early on, which then develops into a larger, a loci out in the field that develops into a much larger and an increasing spot, especially with repeated plantings of susceptible cotton varieties, is that the inoculum densities just keep increasing. And that's sort of reflected in the symptoms or the values that are shown here. You can say severity in terms of plant mortality or vascular stain symptoms on the left. And going across the different levels of inoculum densities, you can see the red and the DP744 are susceptible at much lower inoculum densities than 5072, kind of an intermediate, moderately susceptible Acala, versus phytogen 800, you have to get out to the 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th in a root dip inoculation type of approach to get start seeing damage in that more resistant material. Another thing that's been a consistent thing that we've noticed in field evaluations is that there's some significant year-to-year and location differences in responses to what we think are higher soil inoculum levels from site to site. We check this with indicator susceptible varieties, and we find quite a bit of variation, year to year. You certainly find it within different parts of a field. And another thing that does have an impact, again, because of the timing of when this is hitting these plants, is differences in multiple stresses to which plants are exposed to at different sites and years. So we have locations, whether we're talking about a screening location that we're using or whether it's a regular grower planting, where you can have multiple stresses, seedling diseases, compaction issues in the field, rapid onset of high temperatures, repeated rainfall and chilling events. And that's part of the reason, I think, why the Australians, when they've talked about this in terms of a kind of management approaches, one of the things that they've talked about in terms of lessening injury with the races of FOV that they have dealt with is later planting dates. And so later planting dates is something we've done multiple studies on this and consistently found that later planting dates show less intense vascular staining and lower mortality numbers almost without exception. The problem for that with, say, something like the Pimas, or if you're in a situation like in California where you're trying to grow a long season cultivar and you want high yields in order to pay the bills, people aren't real interested in a May planting date, at least in our location. So planting date's a hard sell. And again, I just wanted to drive home the point, this is some survival percentages of some select varieties across a number of different years and locations, which represent some differing intensities of pressure on these plants. And you can see that you can grow the same cultivars, the ones shown down there on the left, top three are Acalas, and the bottom three are Pimas. And you can see quite a range in susceptibility, although you can clearly identify which ones, tend to be the more resistant and which ones are the more susceptible. A few things I wanted to just mention is that there's a lot of discussion about containment issues and possibilities, and I just want to give a few opinions based on our experiences in California. And I would say that once you know that Fusarium is there, management options include many, including hopefully working with resistant cultivars. But there are some answers, at least I think, that we have under our conditions in California with containment. And a few things to keep in mind. The spores can be very long-lived, such as the chlamydospore, so practices that limit the expansion and movement of the spores is something that can be important. Work done to date, largely by Mike Davis, would indicate that if the question about rotation crops that will reduce inoculum and populations of inoculum, like what our experiences have been with, say, small grains rotations with verticillium, have been fairly successful in helping reduce inoculum populations. We're not aware of anything that does that particularly well with race 4 FOV. And we're quite certain at this point there's not likely anything that's going to eradicate it. Transmissible via infected seed, that was already mentioned, but there were several comments about seed. I would also say seed soil, because anything that is able to be present as a spore in a clod of soil that's on any piece of equipment on a person's shoe, on your vehicle, is another great way of spreading the inoculum. And I'd say that's a very large source of our rapid movement field to field in adjacent areas in California with race 4. Can the strain influence other crop species? Highly unlikely. Can the inoculum be spread with soil transport? I just mentioned, yes. Plant parts, yes. A lot of these will float on the surface of something like a tailwater pond. By irrigation, by cultivation, the answer to all of those is yes, the inoculum can spread very well, and we have a lot of documentation of that in California. Field sanitation approaches used in Australia, they've really touted the successes they've had, I think, which I don't dispute, with the come clean, go clean type of approach. I think to some extent every area that has to deal with a pathogen like this and a soil-borne disease as well as seed-borne disease is to figure out what type of things are practical, cost-effective to try. If they work for the Australians with the crop rotations they have, that's great. I would say that we've had some significant roadblocks that I disagree with the concept that we failed in containment efforts in California. You have to think of what type of things happen when you're in a very diverse type of crop production system. So if you look at crop rotation, you have to have real careful attention to avoiding wet soil operations and movement that you go through. So if you're dealing like we do, cotton rotated with winter vegetables, cotton rotated with tomatoes, we have dust control measures and road watering requirements in California that aid movement of soil. Tailwater reuse systems. I have a number of situations that I've monitored where that's been a method of movement. And again, as I mentioned, everyday movement of equipment, people, transportation, your field scouts, anybody who insists on going into a field when it's wet, if they aren't wearing some kind of booties or something like that, they're likely to move things field to field. Field variety screens, again, containment efforts, in our experience, help buy you some time while you're looking for improved FOV-resistant tolerance cultivars. And some of the approaches, this is just an example shown here of one of the screening sites we had where you can see some susceptible varieties that are more severely infected, and we can have, you know, everything from 0 to 50, 60% survival in those. But if you go and look at them, one of the very important things in a lot of these is if you even have 60, 70% survival, you may have 100% infection in those susceptible varieties in terms of evaluations of root vascular staining. Others grow through it quite well. One of the things that can be a real frustration is you don't want to, in our experience, look at plants and say, well, this one looks really good. Because one of our experiences, I'll mention just something, I'm not going to pick on them, but I'll say it by specifically, something like Hazara hybrids actually hang in there really well right up until the inoculum levels get extremely high. It's a hybrid vigor type of plant. It grows very nicely. It hangs in there really well, but it might be 100% infected in terms of every single plant. So those are all inoculum factories to a degree. And returning those materials to the soil means that you're moving along and increasing inoculum loads. So again, in our experience, you certainly don't want to just judge it based on how does the plant grow in that type of a setting. I wanted to mention a few things about the multiple screening-related efforts that we've had as an approach in California. And again, this is one of those things that sort of evolved over the years. We were just sort of scouting around for what we might expect in the first couple of years. And then we've gone on to including offers basically to put everything that comes in our University of California variety trials and added them to our screening program. Later on, Mauricio worked with Don Jones to get the RBTN program entries added to the cultivar screenings that we do in California for race 4 FOV. And then I'll mention a few things. Since Mauricio Ulloa wasn't able to be here today, I'll mention a few things about the breeding program and some of the molecular efforts that he's had. So in terms of the commercial entries and RBTN screening efforts, and these are in addition to the work that's been done for quite a few years where we had an early focus largely on Pimas. And again, these projects doesn't involve the USDA UC breeding efforts. So the commercial entries have been tested for many years. I'll mention some of the results and how many entries we've had in those. They've been in our variety trials, experimentals that have been chosen to be entered by the seed company reps, usually just numbered experimentals where they know what they are and I don't, other than just providing the data. And then the RBTN data that we also provide then to all of the participants in the RBTN community. So this is just a little bit of an indication of what I did is I took, this does not include the RBTN entries, which has generally been, Don can correct me, I think around 30 or so entries per year while we've been participating in the FOV screening. So this doesn't include those numbers, but the numbers that are shown here are a number of entries on the left axis and some different companies, and these on the bottom are years. So this is 2009. We had also screenings that were done all the way back to 2003. But this is number of entries that came from Monsanto, Bayer, a mix of additional companies, or Phytogen. In uplands, on the left is the U, P for Pima, is the O9P, and the O9H is hybrids. So that's mostly from Hazara. And you can see that we've had some increases in the numbers, a lot of variation in the numbers, certainly increasing quite a bit in terms of upland entries as we got into 2012 and 2013. And then these are the numbers shown. Again, these don't include the RBTN entry numbers. These are numbers shown for 2014, 15, 16, and 17 for, again, uplands are the U, P is Pima, and H is the hybrids, again, largely from Hazara. So again, a fair number of materials. I know that in some of the efforts that are going to be continuing in Texas, as well as hopefully ours in California, we'll have these numbers probably continue to go up in the future. But again, we have looked at quite a few materials over a fair number of years. I'll just mention a couple of the results. I'm not going to go into any details other than just saying that this is one of the ways that we would look at the data and the type of information we'd provide to the RBTN participants. This is root vascular staining index. Again, the lower the number, the better. Again, we'd like to see numbers below, the low ones, 1.2 or less. It means lower vascular staining. It means you have more plants that were probably tested as zeros in terms of vascular staining out of the sampling that was done. And again, you can see that there's not too many that are below the 0.6 for the 2016 year, but there are several that are close to those type of numbers, and hopefully these will be ones that there'll be some follow-up on in terms of potential utility in some FOV resistance programs. Or tolerance programs. And this is the data. The previous one was 2016. This is the information for 2017. And again, similarly, you can see some of them down near that line of about one. The intensity of the damage was a little bit more, was actually significantly worse in 2017 sites than it was in 2016. But again, there's a number of them here I think that'll be of interest. You can see like the NM 13R101, 1015, and several others as well. In addition, as I mentioned, in addition to the RBT entries, there's a number of materials, and again, this is just a sampling. So there's quite a few numbers. You can see in some of those recent years, we might have had as many as 70 different experimental uplands plus variety trial entries that were included in these. And I just wanted to give you an idea across some Phytogen Monsanto and ONA materials in 2017 at two test sites. These are some of the type of numbers that are there. So again, I would assume that these would be a number of different materials that some of the breeders would be interested in going forward with additional tests and evaluations. This is from, and those were Pimas in the prior example. This is commercial upland materials from, again, a wide range of different companies, Fibermax, Delta Pine, CPS, Dynagro, Fibermax, and so on. And again, there's a number of materials. There's certainly some of them that, you know, I clearly would say are not of interest, but there's a number of them here that I think there's some real potential. And again, these are some experimental uplands, additional ones that, again, I think will be under review by the companies. And this is the same slide, again, about the number of entries. Again, I would expect that these numbers would be similar for the program that we're planning for 2018. So I'll just make a few comments about this and then move on to a few comments about Mauricio and the breeding program. And again, what I wanted to mention was that certainly over the years, the cross-section of Pima varieties have represented both ends of the spectrum. They've been the most susceptible ones we've identified and damaged, and they've also produced so far some of the most tolerant and least damaged materials, such as some of the materials from Phytogen in the Pimas and from the Monsanto ONA program as well. The uplands have been consistently and broadly infected and kind of represent the middle group in that. So there's some that look somewhat, I think, quite promising, and a very large number of them that are probably doing a pretty good job of helping to reproduce inoculum. They're surviving. They're not damaged to the same level until the inoculum loads get quite high. So I wanted to mention, since Mauricio wasn't able to be here, a little bit about the breeding program and genetics program that Mauricio has been working on, both when he was in California and then since he's moved and transitioned to Texas, he still helped coordinate and run a program in California. So some of the things that have been looked at over the period of years, both in the Pimas and the uplands that I'll mention, are materials that certainly Mauricio would want to mention that came out of Dr. Percy's program of the USDARS in terms of looking at some of the source materials for the Pima populations, a number of materials out of New Mexico State University, USDARS Stoneville, that Dr. Ulloa brought to Shafter in the early 2000s. And a number of different things were done in terms of crosses and progeny evaluations with those materials. Additional work on older materials from the Shafter germplasm collection. Some of these were resurrected. Some of them were still, you know, active in some of the testing programs in Shafter at the time. And those have been through the testing program along with additional materials from New Mexico. And again, the RBTN efforts were initiated by Mauricio starting in 2007 in cooperation with Don Jones and Ted Wallace and others in that program. In addition, the efforts were made because of the concern and interest in FOV in Australia to look at materials from their testing program. And at least in the early materials that were evaluated, there really was not cross-resistance in terms of how things worked. Their best materials in Australia did not do well in California and vice versa. In addition, there's a number of materials that we've been looking at consistently and then moving forward with as a new potential source of FOV resistance out of Uzbekistan, germplasm collections, and more recently, materials coming out of Peru as well as Egypt have been in the testing program the last year or two. A number of materials have been released over the years. I'm not going to mention these. The focus certainly to this point has been releases, multiple releases made available out of the Pima evaluations that were the focus of some of the early work. And those came at a number of different years and out of a number of different backgrounds in doing that type of work. And what I wanted to mention, in addition, there was a little more of a focus, certainly in the last 5 years or so, on expanding into more work on uplands, including evaluation of some what Mauricio described as 400 obsolete cultivars and SA lines. Identified a number of materials that came out of those, developed a progeny and identified resistance and tolerance that, and a significant number of crosses and combinations. Identified some upland sources out of a number of different materials as part of those ongoing efforts. More recently, a USDARS data transfer agreement, a DTA, has been set up with Cotton Incorporated to provide more detailed information about what's been tested and developed to date in this testing program. And I direct you, if you have some needs or interest in a data transfer arrangement, access to data on test materials, you can contact Dr. Ulloa in USDA in Lubbock, and I can get you in touch with him if you'd like. And then I'll conclude with just basically the comments that, again, what Mauricio has tried to do and what we've tried to cooperate on has been a fairly broad-based long-term genetics and breeding program, looking at investigations into inheritance issues with FOV4, candidate genes involved in FOV resistance, and identification and development of resistant germplasm with an early focus mostly on Pima and more recently continuing efforts in Pima but in expanded efforts in uplands. And again, if you have additional questions, I mean, I can try to deal with some of them, and Mauricio certainly can be another contact. Again, he'd like to have been here today, but he's been he's kind of in the middle of, I think, what a lot of people maybe have been struggling with some of these things going around over the holidays. Okay, thank you. One last thing, I knew I'd come up here and then forget to mention it. I don't have a lot of them, but I've got about, I think about 20, 25 copies of a bulletin that was put together on management of FOV race 4, some of the issues that I just mentioned. This was put together in cooperation with the Cotton Growers Association and then expanded more recently in cooperation with Phytogen Dow. And then there's also a publication list of some of the materials, things that have come out of Mike Davis's, my work, and Mauricio Ulloa's work. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'll ask you to hold your questions for Bob until the session after the next talk.